Welcome in to On the Shore with Max McDoolin and Lucas Moore. I'm Max McDoolin, leading the way as your host today, alongside my good friend Lucas Moore. Alyssa's in studio with us as well. She's just typing away, doing a little bit of work, but she's going to hang out with us maybe for a touch during the show, maybe not, but she's here with us. And we hope that you're here with us too. We're looking forward to a good show today. We've got a lot of big things to talk about in the world of sports. We're going to focus in on football. We're going to touch, of course, on the MLB cheating scandal because that's just truly unavoidable at this point in the sports world. But first, I want to jump into final thoughts on college football and first thoughts on the NFL Super Bowl matchups. Let's jump into those college football final thoughts. It was a really fun national championship game, especially for those who are fans of LSU and of Joe Burrow. We're going to talk about Joe Burrow for a long time coming. I have a good feeling. Lucas, you've already touched on him time and time again. You've been predicting his rise. Maybe not this meteoric, but definitely predicting his rise for a long time.
Not 60 touchdowns. And I didn't think LSU would win the national championship because of what we look back on is how difficult their schedule was. That's what's so impressive about this run is because if you look ahead at the LSU schedule, knowing what they would need to do to become national champions, I just didn't think it was possible. I thought that they were going to slip up. I thought they were going to falter, not because of Joe Burrow, but just because of that type of schedule. It's honestly the toughest run I've seen a college football team make through a season, and they did it with flying colors at the highest level of performance. I loved watching LSU. The thing about LSU, though, is everybody thinks that this is something that's just going to roll back. It's not something that's going to roll back into next year. This is it for LSU as a powerhouse playoff contender program. Maybe they'll be back in a couple years in the future, but they're losing a lot of pieces. They're losing a lot of coaches. They're losing a lot of momentum. And you could see that locker room. Kirk Herbstreit commented on this. It felt like the pinnacle. It felt like the end for a lot of people at LSU. And it's not because they have to play next year, but to me, they're not even in Oklahoma consistency where they'll dominate the conference, be in the playoff. Alabama, I think, will be better than LSU over the next 2-3 years. Clemson is by far and away a better program than LSU, and I think we'll see that play out.
See, I think that's interesting, and I want to jump in on this because it's so rare where you and I have a disagreement. You know, we're normally very much in sync, but on this note, we're actually kind of not in sync. LSU's schedule next season sets them up to build that momentum that you just spoke about that's so important in college football. The schedule this year was so difficult. You take the great successes. There are still 3-star, 4-star, 5-star athletes. But if you look at LSU's schedule next season, they start the year with UTSA at home. That's a win, practically an FCS program. They've gone 8-4 before at the FBS level, but they're not nearly incredible. Texas, we're back. No, you're not. You have to go into Death Valley, play against an LSU team that is the defending national champs. I don't care what Texas pulls out on the table. Herman is a fun matchup, but I don't think Texas is better than LSU.
I think Texas wins that game, though.
And that's fine.
Because I just want to, like, go through this schedule.
Well, that's what I'm doing here.
I'm talking about last year's schedule because you made an interesting point, right?
Okay.
LSU has all these great athletes, and
sure,
you are 100% right, and LSU will always be a 9-11 win program. That's what they've always been. It's what they'll always be. They're one of the best programs. They recruit really well. They've got a great fan base, great stadium to play in. I love Coach O, and I think they'll have some success. What I'm saying is they're not just one of those playoff contenders because they're not going to have a Joe Burrow spit out of LSU every single year. And Miles Brennan talking about he's got next, like he's going to go out and throw 60 touchdowns, is absolutely laughable. What Joe Burrow did, I mean, go through the schedule. 45-38 against Texas. No Joe Burrow, that's a loss. The Vanderbilt game, that offense scored 66 points, but the defense was laughable. I was there at that game. The defense was getting run on. There are worlds in LSU's past where they lose that game to Vanderbilt in a massive upset on the road. You look at Florida, 42-28. Maybe win that game without Joe Burrow, but you surrender 28 points. You win Mississippi State no matter what. Auburn, 23-20.
That's a loss. I agree with
that. That's a loss. Alabama's a loss. You give up 41 points to them. Ole Miss, your defense couldn't play anything. You give up 37.
That's still a win, and I'm going to bounce to that in a second, but keep going.
So to me, that's a borderline win-loss because you would change your game plan. Ole Miss wouldn't have the football as much.
And that's what I'm going to get to here in a second.
Exactly, to where you change back to old LSU football. And then the defense finally came around with Texas A&M and Georgia, and I thought the defense played well against Oklahoma, and I thought the defense played well against Clemson. But they had young pieces on that defense that were trying to figure themselves out. And in any other LSU season, you can't figure yourself out because they didn't have that guy. They didn't have the quarterback. And they've just never been able to have that quarterback consistently. And I would be shocked if Miles Brennan does anything close to what Joe Burrow did this
year. And then that's what I wanted to bounce to. You started talking about game plan. That's why I said that the first time we kind of had this discussion off air that I felt like LSU beats Georgia Southern, beats Texas on the road, obviously beats Northwestern State, beats Vanderbilt, beats Utah State. Now you're 5-0, and in college football, momentum exists, and you've had this great game plan, which LSU has been the master of the grind-it-out style of play. Here's the danger in 2020 that I will agree with you with, is that I don't think LSU was a playoff team this year without Joe Burrow, but I do still believe that they win 10 football games. If you just look at that schedule, I thought that their losses would have been to Florida or Auburn and Alabama. I think everyone else they beat. I think the Florida game, I think Florida and Auburn, I think they would have won one of those games, lost one. I think they would have lost to Alabama. Then whatever their bowl game scenario is probably a toss-up, but probably a win. Now, you looked at 2020. This is my fear. You've created a modern offense. There's a world that exists where Miles Brennan can embrace a new rule and not be Joe Burrow, but he's capable of being a Kyle Allen who had a short stint of success at Texas A&M and is now, you know, done okay in the NFL, or is capable of doing something like Gardner Minshew did at Washington State, where he is a better quarterback than we thought he is. But really what LSU has to do to meet or exceed expectations, I think, next year is they don't have to close the offense back up, but they do have to resort to being a time of possession team. They have to be very cognizant of the fact that when they're at the 48-yard line and it's 4th and 5 or longer, you're going to punt. You're going to pin the other team in the end zone. You're going to let the defense play football. So that is why, you know, you look at that Texas matchup at home in week 2, it is interesting because LSU is going to play the style of game they played against UTSA, and they're going to possibly put up 50 points, and it's going to look like, oh, LSU is what they were last year. Well, UTSA is, again, you know, a Mid-American Conference team type team. They're in the Conference USA, but I mean they're a MAC-level team, in my point of view, at their best. And now you got to play Texas. Are you going to be willing to play time of possession? Are you going to be willing to play defense? Are you going to be willing to play special teams? Or are you going to try and blow out Texas? That's not going to work because Tom Herman is an amazing offensive mind who is really going to pull out some stops against you. And I think that's the question mark right there. But well, again, to me, I think that this team should start the year 8-0 heading into the Alabama game. I think they should. They might not. But I really believe that they are the better team than UTSA, Texas, Rice, Ole Miss at home, Nichols, Florida on the road, Arkansas on the road, and Mississippi State at home. They should be favored. They should be heavily favored in a lot of those games. And they should be 8-0 with a bye week heading into Alabama, which gives you a chance. It gives you a chance.
Yeah, I think that it all comes down to the thing that we've credited Ed Orgeron all this season with, which is his ability to be self-aware and understand what he's capable of and understand what his program is capable of. The problem is going 15-0 and winning a national championship and being the greatest team in college football history can change attitudes and can change perception. My fear is that LSU over the course of this offseason will start to believe that what they did was because of them and not Joe Burrow. Now, they had a hand in it. 100% had a hand in it. Would Joe Burrow have been able to do this if he went to North Carolina? No, of course not. LSU had the frontline athletes that if you get a signal caller in who knows what he's doing, who understands how to lead, who understands how to elevate players, that the program would take off. That wouldn't have happened in North Carolina, wouldn't have happened at Cincinnati, wouldn't have happened at Nebraska, even if Nebraska had been able to if Nebraska would have been smart enough to let Joe Burrow, the kid that dreamed about playing there his entire life, come and quarterback their program. But now, I think Nebraska would have been a playoff team, but they wouldn't have been this. LSU just has all these great athletes that are unbelievable all over the field, and they just needed that leader, that signal caller, to elevate them. If Ed Orgeron realizes that Joe Burrow was huge in that and is able to be self-aware and play that strategy that you said, and LSU just be its normal defensive-focused, run-based, 10 to 12 win self with still playing the spread offense but more run heavy, I think maybe they can be 8-0. But to me, I just it feels like a cliff is coming after such an amazing year. That's not a bad thing for LSU, too. They can celebrate this for 20 years.
Also, I just find it a little bit hard, too, with no Tua Tagovailoa. I mean, I think that Alabama next season, no matter who's got next, no matter who's coming in, at the end of the day, I think Nick Saban is probably going to look at that team again as more of an A.J. McCarron-style team. I think we're going to see Alabama a little bit more of pro style as well, which to me, guess what? They've got, just like LSU, they've got three quarters of a season to figure things out. But I don't see why we say immediately that they should be favored in that game either, because they're going through a massive transition period as well at Alabama.
I think in 3 years, though, what we're going to end up saying is, wow, LSU interrupted for a brief second one of the most dominant runs in college football history that's about to happen from Clemson.
And, I
think Clemson is going to win the national championship next year. That'll be Trevor Lawrence's last year, but the way that they've got their program rolling, there might be another guy like him right behind him.
Well, and I think
so. It could be a 3 year stretch here, 4 year stretch where Clemson wins 3 out of 4 titles.
Yep.
And LSU and Joe Burrow are the only reason they didn't win 4 straight.
Well, and there are some fun games on the schedule for Clemson next year, at least in my point of view, a little bit more fun than they had this season. And one is on the road at Notre Dame, which at the end of the day,
we should go to that game.
That would be a lot of fun.
That's right. Come on. Yeah. We should get those tickets. I got a contact. We'll see.
But that would be... that's going to be tough, you know, for anybody, and that is by far their toughest opponent on the schedule. But then they have a couple of other that are just more interesting matchups inside of the ACC that this year maybe weren't as interesting, but next year will be I think more interesting. At Florida State, that program has to at least take a step up where they're able to start. Maybe it's not competition, but you're on the road at Florida State. And again, Florida State's a mess right now, but at some point they're going to start building back on track.
Well, and the recruiting base is just so good.
Feels like a trap game, right? They play on the road at Wake Forest, which is a top 40 program, so that's a little bit better. At Georgia Tech, which all of a sudden has really kind of opened things up a little bit more. So the ACC style of play, Louisville, which was fun this season for a moment, that's going to be competitive. So I think it's going to be interesting, you know, and we'll see what happens. You know, they play South Carolina at home. I don't see that being really a tough matchup. But still, the schedule for Clemson next year looks tougher than it was this season. They will get tested a couple more times in the regular season than they were this year. But I think for Clemson, that's a good thing.
Yeah, and I just don't...
Because they're still favored in all these games.
Yeah, and Clemson won't have such a big head heading into next year. I think this loss for them is really going to help propel their run over the next 2-3 years.
Yeah.
But they're the best program in college football. They'll have the best quarterback in college football next year. And they have the best coach, I think, right now because of his assistant coaching staff, able to elevate him to be the best coach he can. Because Nick has just lost so many assistants to so many places. And that's not a criticism of Nick Saban at all. It's a part of the gig. You're going to lose a lot of assistants when you're that great. And we'll see if that happens to Dabo anytime soon. But right now he's keeping everybody around him. I think that they are the best situation to be in.
They're paying a lot of money to keep a lot of those guys around.
Oh, yeah, and Clemson's really dedicated themselves. And I really regret something. Back in high school, there's this kid named Jordan. I won't give out his last name, you know, for he knows who he is. Jordan was a huge Clemson fan. And I remember the year before this thing took off for Clemson, I was making fun of Clemson. I was like, Clemson's never won anything. Clemson is not
a lot of people were.
I was like, Clemson's not a bread-winning program. I don't know what you're getting so excited for. Like, so what, you're 6-0. And the next thing you know, just star after star after star, national championships. And now I'm sitting here on a radio show podcast saying, hey, Clemson's the best program in college football, and it isn't really close. So it's amazing how quickly these things can turn, how quickly a great coach with a great mind with an athletic program that's willing to invest in their football program. Now we can go through the ethical things of that on another podcast, but if you're willing to invest in your football program, you can turn around, you can become dominant if you get the right people in place, which is what Clemson did. It's just interesting to me who will be the next team after Clemson to take that jump. Will it be an old-time power? I think Notre Dame, you can cross them off the list. I don't think they'll ever take that jump. I think we've seen them try a bunch of times. I think they're going to always have great coaches. They're always going to have this aura about them that they're Notre Dame. I think they'll make a couple playoff appearances here and again, but
well, I think
they'll
Notre...
never reach. I don't think they'll. I really think it's unrealistic they ever win in modern college football with the way recruiting works. I don't think it's realistic they'll ever win a national championship.
Yeah,
barring a star quarterback like Joe Burrow.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I think it would take someone like an Andrew Luck, a Joe Burrow, a Deshaun Watson,
Joe Montana, right?
To someday carry that team. Just to quickly wrap up this section. Are there any final thoughts on the college football? Is there a team? Here's my question to you. Is there a team that was a top 10 program this year that you're really concerned about heading into next season? I'll give you mine right now. Mine's Oklahoma. It's a team that's been carried by transfer quarterbacks multiple seasons in a row. It's a program that's been carried by transfer quarterbacks over time, and they're still in a transition period that we thought for a moment Lincoln Riley wasn't going to be the same as Bob Stoops, but so far he has been. They've fallen on the biggest stage in a lot of different moments, which is what Bob Stoops got to be known for late in his career. When Oklahoma beat Ohio State on the road with Lincoln Riley, we thought that Oklahoma was past that stage of falling in the big moments, and now they've done it multiple years in a row in the playoff. So that's my team where I don't really know what they're going to be next year or what they're going to be going forward. Who's your team that was a top 10, top 15 program that you see maybe red flags for going into the next season or maybe even next couple of seasons? Or is there one?
Well, honestly, looking at the top 10 right now, I like Minnesota. Penn State, it feels like, is going to hang around at the top of the Big Ten. Alabama's Alabama. Oklahoma, I'm really not concerned about Oklahoma. I agree with you. Maybe they're not ever a national championship team, but they're the best team in that conference.
So maybe is it LSU?
I really think it's LSU. Oregon, maybe, but I really think it's LSU.
Because Orgeron has to prove himself past this Burrow season.
But it's not even forget what Orgeron proves himself anyway. When you win a championship like this, the way they did it, as dominant as they did it, then you lose as many players like they did. You lose as many coaches like they did. When you capture football like they did out of nowhere, that usually doesn't repeat. This is a perfect combination of everything. I just think LSU won't be within the top 10 come at the end of next season. I feel like they're the most likely team out of the top 10 to drop out, yeah. I'm not an LSU fan though, so I'm not really sad to say that. I was a Joe Burrow fan. Now he's gone, I could care less what happens to LSU. I like Coach O. I wish them the best of success, but I just think this was a perfect ship, a perfect car to be driven by the best race car driver, but it needs the best driver to be that front-running car. It isn't as explosive or as fast or has the same turning capability as the cars like Alabama, Clemson, so on and so forth.
I think at Orgeron,
Florida, I think Florida might get LSU next year.
Yeah.
Florida's a good program.
Even though Jamarcus Russell was no Joe Burrow in college, I will say LSU's in the same spot that they were. Les Miles comes in. It was his first season, I believe. That in his first season, LSU goes 11-2. That was the second year of Jamarcus Russell. The next season, Jamarcus Russell, they go 11-2. They win the Sugar Bowl, and everyone's question was: is this Les Miles? Is this a carryover from Nick Saban? Les Miles has to prove himself post Jamarcus Russell. And then the next season, they won the national championship without him. So I think that Ed Orgeron I have to prove myself post Joe Burrow.
Watching Jamarcus Russell eat his way out of the NFL probably shows who won that argument.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, so I want to go ahead and jump into the NFL. We spent a lot of time on college football. So NFL, not a massive preview, but we're going to jump into a little bit. We're going to go ahead and take a break. We'll be right back after this. And we're back in. Max McDoolin, Lucas Moore, this is the On the Shore podcast. So, not going to go into a deep dive of the Super Bowl matchup. We definitely will do that on a future podcast. But just like we gave our final thoughts on college football, what are your first thoughts on the Super Bowl, and what are your final thoughts on the NFL season in general? My first thought is that this Super Bowl makes a lot of sense. I think the 49ers have been one of the toughest teams, have followed a very NFL-specific path to get to this point, whereas the Chiefs have followed the modern NFL path to get to this point. The 49ers have won in whatever way was necessary, whether it was throwing the football, whether it was running the football, whether it was playing tough defense. They've gotten to the point this way. They remind me a lot of a great deal of the New England Patriots when Tom Brady first took over at the starting quarterback job, whereas you look at the Kansas City Chiefs, I think they actually remind me a lot of what the New England Patriots looked like when Tom Brady was truly in his prime. So it's two teams that make a lot of sense. I thought for a moment, I really, really thought that the Titans were going to be the team that possibly pulled the upset and made it into the Super Bowl, but Patrick Mahomes proved to me something that you've been saying a lot. It's all about the quarterback.
Yeah, and he's just special. My first thought is, wow, I'm so happy I don't have to watch Ryan Tannehill skip 10-yard slant routes in the Super Bowl. Like, it's been...
This is the most entertaining Super Bowl matchup we probably could have
gotten. It's been a rough run here with quarterbacks because you get Tom Brady old last year, Jared Goff, who never really excited me. I mean, Jared Goff is just this classic, okay, he's pretty good. Decent arm, nothing special.
Yeah.
Right? And that's okay, and he could be a Matt Ryan type of player, which is fine.
Yeah, Matt Ryan was never
pretty good.
Incredible
good
to
arm.
Watch. Yeah.
And I think Andy Dalton was in that stratosphere for a while.
Sure.
Pretty good, good arm, nothing special. And that's a fine class to be in, but it's not really entertaining to
there
watch.
There are Super Bowl winning quarterbacks in that class, obviously. Yeah,
exactly. And then you go back the year previous, you get to watch Tom Brady, but Nick Foles? Now, I know he played great. But I just, you know, it was a great storyline for the Eagles, but I never really got into Nick Foles. Maybe it's not I just didn't buy the storyline as much. But to me, this is a great storyline. It's Patrick Mahomes, possibly the greatest thing since Dan Marino, and he's had success at a younger age more than anybody since Dan Marino. I saw a stat, only quarterbacks younger than this to appear in the Super Bowl includes Dan Marino, Ben Roethlisberger, and then a couple other randoms, and none of them won the game, and all of them performed poorly. Jimmy Garoppolo, meanwhile, is 28, but Patrick Mahomes actually has more starts, and everybody's criticizing Jimmy G. I get the 6-for-8, 77 yards, and oh, he's a game manager, they play good defense, and they run the football. How did Tom Brady's career start, people?
Yep, exactly.
Everybody called him a game manager. Everybody called him, he's only winning because of the Patriots and the defense, and then they just kept winning games, and kept winning games, and he kept making big throws. And then he started to really figure it out, got the right weapons around him, and then became an MVP caliber player. It wasn't he's jumping in, he's an MVP caliber player right away. Not saying Jimmy G will be the next Tom Brady, but Bill Belichick saw the same things in Jimmy G that he saw in Tom Brady all those years ago. So I think that there's something to say about that, especially with his record compared to the Niners record, who were a 4-12 team a year ago.
Exactly.
After he got hurt. To me, that's an interesting storyline. To me, I feel like it's an interesting quarterback. Now, he might not throw the ball more than 20 times.
And it also doesn't mean the things you're stating about him, the similarities to Tom Brady's storyline, doesn't mean that, you know, 2 years from now or next season, he throws 35 touchdown passes and really is this quarterback who's threading the needle and throwing the ball
forever.
A lot more. Or he could be this forever. But again, there are some great quarterbacks, great teams that have been led by guys like Jimmy G who have won titles this way. And I think Ben Roethlisberger, by the way, is another quarterback
actually,
who was a game manager.
Check that stat I said earlier. The only quarterback to win the Super Bowl at an age younger than Patrick Mahomes.
Against Kurt Warner in the Arizona Cardinals, right?
No.
Is that? Oh, sorry.
It was 2005. It was the Seattle Seahawks,
yep.
Matt Hasselbeck,
yep.
And Sean Alexander, who's on the cover of Madden.
Yep.
The year following.
Came up 1 yard short from a 2,000-yard season.
And he, and that game, Ben Roethlisberger, they won, but Ben Roethlisberger had the lowest passer rating by a winning quarterback in Super Bowl history.
Yep.
In that game. So this is usually how it goes for young quarterbacks. It's not how it's going to go for Patrick Mahomes. This guy's the greatest show on turf. He is brilliant to watch. He is combining the position of shortstop and quarterback with his movement outside of the pocket. He's electric. He can throw it as far as he pot. Like, everything that's entertaining about every quarterback in the league, he has that component.
Yeah.
He has that aspect. Good dude, too. Good energy guy. And you give him a really, really good opponent for him. He would have ripped up the Packers defense. This 49ers defense has dudes, has old stars. Richard Sherman on the back end, right? Richard Sherman's a big star. This is good for the Super Bowl. You've got a young star in Nick Bosa on the front. A great defensive line, right? A menacing defensive line. And you have two in the NFL 100 season. It's not the Eagles are thrown in there, right? It's not the Rams who, yes, have been in there with the 2000s, but they aren't this blue blood like franchise. That is what the Kansas City Chiefs and the San Francisco 49ers are. The AFC Championship trophy was named after Lamar Hunt.
Oh, that was a beautiful, right? That was a neat scene, wasn't
exactly,
that?
Exactly, right? So that is a blue blood franchise, one of the original dominators of the AFC. And then you have the most dominant franchise in the 80s.
By the way, not one of the original dominators of the AFC, the original dominator of the AFC. And just real quick, I just wanted to clean up. The cool moment was seeing the Lamar Hunt trophy getting passed to Clark Hunt, who's the CEO of the Chiefs. I just wanted to clean that up for a moment. And Andy Reid said that was one of the most surreal moments of his life, was to pass on the Hunt trophy to the Hunt family. Yeah. Really neat.
There you go, another storyline. Andy Reid, a guy who's been coaching forever.
Exactly,
and
that's why I think the juxtaposition of that Steelers-Seahawks matchup is actually really interesting, even though it's a very dynamic offense, and that Matt Hasselbeck-led offense wasn't really dynamic. You had an offensive mind in Mike Holmgren, who was phenomenal in the sport of football, was an absolute innovator, built a great team, and had won a Super Bowl, but had also come up short countless times. Andy Reid has come up short so many times, has been in this league so long, and here he is, the offensive innovator, versus a young head coach, a young quarterback, or youngish quarterback. And it's just, again, it's another fun storyline is the coaching matchup. You've got Kyle Shanahan, who, by the way, another
is
neat moment.
A legacy guy, right?
Mike Shanahan was who handed off the trophy to him on the stage the other night, his dad. So, you know, it really does. It covers countless storylines. As we kind of wrap up this first look into the Super Bowl, what are your first thoughts? Are your first thoughts Kansas City or are your first thoughts San Francisco? You know, we both come from different schools of thought. I still believe that the NFL, as dominated as it is by quarterbacks, you need to have a good quarterback and a great team. You tend to fall in this category of a great quarterback along with a good team can accomplish anything. So I think I'm probably leaning San Francisco. I assume you're probably leaning Kansas City, but enlighten us there on what your thought process is.
Well, it's just San Francisco has the one thing that stops a great quarterback, which is an unbelievable pass rush. Like being able to send four and drop the other seven.
And even sometimes send three and still get someone in his face.
Someone get there-ish, right? I think that this is a dead even matchup. You know, I thought that the line would come out for San Francisco because of just how dominant they looked over Green Bay. But Vegas didn't read into it because they'd blown out Green Bay earlier in the year. But we've seen San Francisco get challenged by great quarterbacks time and time again. Russell Wilson specifically nearly took the one seed from them. It's so hard to pick this one. It really is even. I'm going to lean towards the better quarterback. When I don't know who to pick, I tend to lean towards the better quarterback. Because Kansas City can get pressure too, and Kansas City was the only team to slow down Derrick Henry. It was the first time anybody's really figured it out. And I think Kansas City's defense has been pretty good in the back half of the season. It's the Super Bowl. I think they'll be energetic. I think they'll be alive. It's in Miami. That should be a fast turf.
I was going to
ask. Hopefully no rain.
If that changes anything
right,
for you.
Right, fast turf, Miami, hopefully good weather. Doesn't Hard Rock Stadium have a pullout roof though? I don't know. We need to look that up.
They've remodeled it.
I know that it's closed off some in the stands. I don't know if they have a retractable roof or not. But if it rains, that definitely would push it to San Francisco in my mind, just because the Chiefs.
Yeah, it's just a partial roof. It does not close.
Roof.
It's kind of like the old Dallas Cowboys stadium.
Yeah, but most Miami Super Bowls tend to be clear weather. So knock on wood for that. If it's clear weather, warm night, to me, that's just going to make it really difficult on the defensive line and
if it is rainy, then all of a sudden, I think both of us agree that it just favors San Francisco a ton. They've got an offensive line that pushed everyone around, run dominant team. I think the only way that Kansas City would be able to compete with that, which is they have an innovative mind in Andy Reid would kind of have to pull out all the stops of a lot of triple option, a lot of sweep, a lot of, you know, RPO, you know, where, okay, it's going to be short, it's going to be ugly, but we're going to get the ball out of Mahomes' hands. We're going to let him do a little Deshaun Watson type thing. And that's tough. That's tough.
See,
because
like,
a lot of mistakes can happen when you have three options in one play.
I'm just thinking of how cool it would be. This is the only way it's cool if there's rain, is if it is pouring, like drenching rain, like floods. You can see water on the field, and it's this old school, because it's NFL 100, right? You go back to the source of football, this old school, everybody's got mud on their uniforms, people are getting the snot knocked out of them, but the Chiefs somehow win a 16-13 game because Patrick Mahomes, even in the rain, could throw through it, right? Could throw through the rain. And there's something special when you can throw through weather. That's what made Tom Brady so legendary, is he'd walk out in no matter the elements.
Peyton Manning could not do this. Tom Brady could.
And he'd walk out no matter the elements, and he would throw the ball right through.
I think that's also one of the things that makes someone like Ben Roethlisberger so impressive. He oftentimes has strived in those moments because his team is capable of playing in that environment, and his ball is capable of penetrating through that environment. I'm not saying I'm rooting for this, but we talk about college football. We talk about the NFL. Watching LSU-Alabama's 9-6 game of the century, I thought it was the most entertaining five field goal game I've ever seen in my life. I've rewatched it, I watched it in person, and I loved it. I'm not rooting for that, but what you're talking about right there is that if you have that type of a game, there's this weird feeling that these two teams could figure out a way to make any matchup interesting.
Yeah,
I'm just
scared. It's a great matchup. That's the thing. I'm sitting here thinking, I just think it's going to be a great game. It's going to come down to a kickoff return or a fumble or a great interception on the sideline or a bad timeout in the second half. Like, this is what this game is going to come down to.
My only fear is that we talked up this Seahawks-Broncos matchup so hugely. Broncos were one of the most prolific offenses of all time. Seahawks were on this big come up, had a good defense, had all this, and
the
then
best defense in the league.
And that then the Broncos just got dominated. I really hope that I just am rooting so hard for a good matchup. I'm rooting for no team. I'm rooting for no player. I just want it to be an awesome game.
I just want to see, the only thing I'm rooting for is I want to watch Patrick Mahomes become the greatest quarterback I've ever seen, right? That's what I want to root for, so that it's that much better when Joe Burrow takes the AFC from him in a few years.
I love it. So let's just wrap up with just 3 minutes. Let's extend this just by 3 minutes because we can't not touch on it in today's podcast, and that is the MLB cheating scandal. It's impossible not to talk about this on a sports show, I think. I have two questions. Is the punishment enough, and how tainted is the Astros title? I'll give you 90 seconds to respond to that.
Oh, I think the punishment is fine. It is what it is. I don't think that the title is tainted because I don't think it helped that much. Listen, everybody gets advantages. Cheating has been, unfortunately or fortunately, however you want to see it, a integral part of baseball for years, for decades. It's the game, right? Spitballs, tar on the jersey. You know, watch the movie Major League. I get it's a joke, but it's also not a joke, right?
Guys were playing on speed.
And Trevor Bauer talks about how all the pitchers cheat in some way, right? Whether they're rubbing the ball a certain way. Like a cool way is you sharpen your fingernail and you file it. You sharpen your fingernail and you file it. Just file the ball a little bit. You give yourself a little extra grip on your curveball. That's cheating. Not allowed to Everybody cheats in the margins in baseball. Now, I think it was wrong. I'm not saying that they should be allowed to do it. I think it was way outside the rules. I think it was egregious. It was over-the-top cheating. But to me, it just didn't matter enough because they still had to hit the ball, they still had to field the ball, and they still had to pitch. And you can know what pitch is coming a lot. Aroldis Chapman, I made this argument. How many fastballs does he throw? About 85, 90%. You know it's a fastball, but you still have to hit it. It's a complete different thing knowing how to hit it. And all these pitchers coming out and saying these quotes about how much of a disadvantage it is, to me, it just is a cop-out for guys who didn't perform well in big moments. Because if you know it's a slider, if you still paint the outside corner and throw a perfect pitch, it's not getting hit, right? You still have to make a mistake for a pitch to get hit.
Sure, Aroldis Chapman may have thrown that pitch to Jose Altuve 100 miles an hour, but he also left it right where Jose Altuve loves the pitch, right at his chest, right over the middle of the plate. But again, as we wrap this up, here's my thing on it. You brought this up off air yesterday, yesterday was Monday night.
Yeah.
You said you're really interested to see on whether what the Astros do this year. I think you're right. It is very important for baseball that the Astros are still good this season.
Yeah.
Because if they're not, then all of us will continue to ask the questions, how much of an edge did this really give them? And that's the thing. You know, my concern, though, with the cheating, I don't think the punishment was enough. I love the Astros. I love baseball. But one of the things that I love about the sport is, yes, you cheat within the margins of the game. It's the same as, in my point of view, what they did is equivalent to what Lance Armstrong did. Yes, his argument was that everyone was doing it. Yeah, A lot of people were doping in racing. A lot of people were using HGH or using steroids. But no one else was going to the point that they were receiving blood transfusions the night of a race to have more oxygen capacity in their legs. That is taking it to an extra level. Using video replay to know exactly what pitch is coming. And again, we'll never know the extent of, you know, what did this mean? What did that mean? Yes, they knew a changeup was coming, but also were they figuring out a way to tell their hitters where the pitch was even supposed to be? We'll never know that extent, and I think that it just took it too far, which sucks because, you know, your hope is that, yes, your team is going to do some things that break the rules. You know, for example, the Tom Brady thing, putting a little bit too little air in the football, it wasn't that crazy. You know, there are other ways to cheat that are okay. This was so much that it really does taint the title. I don't want it stripped from him, but it's very, very tainted.
Yeah, I don't want to use the word tainted for it. I don't taint Barry Bonds' home run record, although I call Hank Aaron the home run king because we know it was clean. But I'm not, like, using the word. It's just, I think Lance Armstrong would have won those races. I just think that him doing that extra transfusion that nobody was doing, that's why he was a great
racer.
But again, because it's because if you go the extra mile in cheating, you have obviously, in athletics, you have gone the extra mile everywhere else as well. Like, I think Tom Brady goes the extra mile to get 11.5 PSI in the football because he goes the extra mile in everything he does in football. Like, we mentioned Jamarcus Russell. Jamarcus Russell probably didn't even know that you could change the PSI in your football because he didn't go the extra mile in quarterbacking. He didn't go the extra mile in sport.
Whereas guys like Deshaun Watson and Patrick Mahomes, we know they do. We know that they do.
Yes.
We know that history behind them. And guess what? Some people, like Johnny Unitas, can survive on not knowing the intricacies of the game and be unbelievably athletic enough and unbelievably amazing enough that they can party hard and get away with it, and they don't need the intensity behind it. My only thing is that this can of worms that you're opening of that, hey, you know, because they went the extra mile cheating, you know, it proves that they go the extra mile everywhere else. Well, like I said, like you said with the Astros, it's important that they're good again this year. Lance Armstrong really didn't do anything competitively after he got caught, and it wasn't just because he got banned. He did participate in other races, triathlons, Ironmans, and things like that, and he never won because he didn't have that edge anymore, I think. So, I mean, again, it's a complicated issue, but it's all there.
Yeah, I think it's certainly a complicated issue, and again, I'm not saying that cheating should be done. It's the responsibility of these leagues, these organizations, these races, these everythings, these governing bodies to crack down on it and make sure that it is a fair game for everybody and everybody's.
It's what we love about sports at the high school level and
without
at the college level is that we've played it. We know there's no outside force affecting it.
Exactly.
And we hope these governing bodies are keeping it the same way at the professional level.
But as a commentator and as an opinion guy, I'm just not going to come out and say that they were not deserving of being a champion because they did this or that. And I'm not going to take away a title from anybody because I watched it happen. And so many other things outside of cheating have to be accomplished
sure. In
sports. It's like saying an official decided a matchup. To me,
there's so many other things that went into it.
There's so many other things that went into it that I can't take away a title just because it helped you 1% or 2%.
Well, thanks for listening in today. This has been Max McDoolin and Lucas Moore on the Shore podcast. We'll catch you next time from here in Chicago, Illinois.